Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, a very blessed Holy Week to you. We're right in the midst of Holy Week. Today is called Spy Wednesday. I don't know if all the days of Holy Week have a name. I really don't know. But if not, then today is the start of the named days. Spy Wednesday today, Holy Thursday tomorrow, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and then, of course, Easter Sunday. So we're getting right into the thick of it. It's going to be an Ask Me Anything today, so if you've got questions about Easter, about Good Friday, about all the events of that fateful Passover weekend 2,000 years ago, you're welcome to call. Or if you've got a question about anything else, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. He's an apologist here at Catholic Answers, writer of a whole bunch of books, including The Eucharist is Really Jesus and Pope Peter and A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times, a whole bunch. Joe Heschmeyer, welcome.
Thanks. And by the way, all of the days of Holy Week are just called, like, well, the first ones are just Holy Monday, Holy Tuesday.
Oh.
Spy Wednesday, Maundy Thursday is the name in England, from Mandatum, and then Good Friday, and then Holy Saturday. So,
oh, yeah, Maundy Thursday.
This is a lot of cool names for days of the week during Holy Week.
There's never a shortage of stuff to memorize as a Catholic. We have so much stuff. Like, we got Holy Thursday, but you know what? Also, you can call it Maundy Thursday.
I mean, you know, the best day for this is Mardi Gras. So you've got Fat Tuesday in English, but it's also called Shrove Tuesday.
Oh, right.
And it's called Pancake Tuesday. And just for good measure, we add in the French Mardi Gras. Which that just means Fat Tuesday in French.
I feel like Mardi Gras came first of all those. Shrove Tuesday, of course, means you're supposed to go to confession on that day.
Pancake Tuesday means you're supposed to eat pancakes.
Well, I do the pancakes first just in case you get a little out of hand at your pancake party. And then go get shriven.
Yes, very good. We don't use shriven.
We don't shrove or shriven or shrift. Very much. Except what we say this. Oh, he gave him short shrift. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about shrift being related to Shrove until you said that. That's really good. Short shrift. I would love a short shrift.
Sometimes I feel like, please, Father, just give me a short shrift. There's a lot of people out there. I don't want to be one of those people that I come out and they go, wonder what took that guy so long.
I've had times where the priest is like telling me interesting stuff, and meanwhile, I know people behind me are like, "Did he kill someone?"
I know he's a murderer. This guy's a murderer. Here he comes. Oh, it's Joe Heschmeyer. He murdered someone. if you're not Catholic and you've never stood in a confession line, well, you should be, and you should, and then you would know what we're talking about. 888-318-7884. Oh, in addition, of course, to receiving the infinite mercy of the Lord, you'd also know what we're talking about. 888-318-7884 is the number. I did not mention, but Joe is also the man behind Shameless Popery, an absolutely wonderful podcast, formerly blog, now podcast, that everybody's talking about. I don't know anybody who's not talking about Shameless Popery. You should check it out.
I want to say this in the nicest way possible. I think you need to meet more people.
Well, everyone here in the studio talks about it. I don't get out a lot, but everyone here in the studio. I thought that was everyone, but all right, on my way home when I stop at 7-Eleven, I will ask, how many of you people have heard of Shameless Popery?
That's a good idea. Tell me what they say.
All right, I will. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. You want to just go straight to the phones, Joe? How do you feel about that?
Please, let's do it.
All right, let's start with Frank in New York City. New York City! Hello, Frank.
That's an El... Yeah, I got the reference.
Old El Paso. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, I went to Frank in New York City, and then he hung up on me. It was because I did an old El Paso voice. Frank, call back. We love talking with people from New York City. New York City people are always so polite and friendly. We love them. Call. It's not like those rude Southerners and Midwesterners we usually have to talk to.
I like that you've managed to insult most of the country in just the first few minutes. Hey, foreign callers, get ready. He might have some more insults for you.
Oh, just wait. Just wait till someone calls from Great Britain. All right, we'll try Kirk in Redondo Beach, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Kirk, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, can you hear me? Or?
Very well, yes.
Sure can.
Okay, so try to formulate it as clear and concise as possible. Like, you know, so the magisterium has, you know, levels of authority and on faith and morals and not strictly scientific matters. Like, it doesn't, it's not going to have anything on the chemical construct of zinc or anything. You're not going to find that. And but there are seeming like scientific issues that are directly related to faith and morals, like maybe like abortion was the example I was thinking of. So that's, you know, intrinsically we would say from conception to natural death, you know, that take the end of that's murder. But maybe like a someone who studies that is a PhD in biology says, yeah, but life just doesn't start at conception. That's a scientific matter. And I disagree because it's science. So what level of authority does the magisterium have on issues like that that are science, but they're directly related to faith and morals?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And actually, the example you give is a really good one, because for a long time, the origins of human life were shrouded in some degree of mystery. So, you know, even things we take as just very basic kind of biology 101 of sperm and egg and conception, a lot of that was very recent science in the scheme of things. And so while those things were still unclear, the church couldn't opine on questions of, you know, how is it that a human biologically comes about? What the church could say is once a human exists, it's murder to kill them. Once a human organism is brought into existence, taking their life isn't a scientific question from a moral perspective. It is a moral and ethical and religious question. So you can have the scientific question, is X a living human organism? And then you can have the moral question, is it morally wrong to kill a living human organism? And so biologically, we know life begins at conception from a scientific perspective. And the church has stated this with, you know, sufficient clarity, but not by its own light. Just saying, given what we know, this is what we mean when we're talking about a human life. So a scientist can't tell you, you know, when a soul is present. But if you understand the soul is a form of the body, then as soon as you have a living body, you have a soul. And so science can tell you when you have a living body. There are these tricky cases, and I can think of two. One of those would be the very precise moment of conception. So the moment of conception when you have something like in vitro fertilization, where you can start to fuse sperm and egg and then stop and undo it. This is one of the many ways we try to play God with this process. And we can't tell you down to the exact like millisecond right now. We can say once sperm and egg are fused, you have a living human organism, and therefore this is a human being worthy of all the respect and dignity any other human being is owed. The second case that's actually a confusing one is the case of twins. And at this point, the church has not settled in any kind of authoritative way how we should think of the process of the individual human organisms, the individual human beings, in the case of identical twins, what are called monozygotic twins. Because at some point, the zygote splits, and you clearly have two human beings for the rest of their life. But at what moment you have both of them as opposed to one is a little bit of a scientifically unsettled question, and therefore the church hasn't spoken on it. But we know whether it's one or two people present, or however you make sense of that, it's still clearly murder to intentionally kill one or two babies. And so in a certain way, the question is kind of moot. So, I mean, using that as kind of an example, I would just say the church respects the unique competence of economics, of science, of fill-in-the-blank field, and then applies moral principles. So you can say scientifically, economically, whatever else, this is the best way to get from point A to point B in terms of efficiency. the church still might have something to say about, well, this is not an ethical way of proceeding. Like, I know I can make money doing this, but it'd be immoral too. Or I know we could, you know, use stem cells from embryos, or if we did human testing on people, then we could maybe get some great advancements in science, and the church would still say it's not okay to do that. So the other place the church steps in is applying morality to the discipline, so you don't proceed with a kind of ends justify the means mentality. Do those distinctions make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they do. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, absolutely.
That makes perfect. Yeah, it makes sense. And that was
wonderful.
Kirk, thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thanks very much, Kirk. I appreciate the call. I got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer of the podcast Shameless Popery that everybody's talking about right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father Gail Hammerschmidt of St. Isidore's Catholic Student Center on the campus of Kansas State University. When I was young, they used to tell me, you know that you become what you eat. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that my thoughts will affect who I become. And when I listen to Catholic radio, I am surrounded by the thoughts that lead me to His glory. I invite you as well to find power in Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. All our lines are full, so let us put Joe Heschmeyer to work. We've got Frank back in New York City.
I find a lot of people in New York are Frank.
Oh, they can be quite Frank. That is true. I bet he's never heard that before either. Is that the first time you've heard your name used that way, Frank?
I've heard when I meet somebody named Frank, two Franks, no mustard. So,
I mean, you're probably pretty close to Nathan's hot dog Coney Island 4th of July extravaganza there, right? Isn't that, is that on Long Island or where? I guess,
yeah.
I think Coney Island.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's right there in the name.
Yeah.
I don't actually know where Coney Island is, but
it's over there. If you go across the thing and you go down that, then Coney Island's over there.
Yeah, it's like in Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's what I was saying. Brooklyn, right. Go ahead, Frank, with your question.
Yeah, my question involves the concept of what's known as an apostolic pardon. I was listening to an apologetic show years ago, and the apologist on there said every time you go to a confession, he says you should ask the priest for an apostolic pardon. So I did. Next time I went to confession, and I says, Father, could you please give me an apostolic pardon? He said to me, I just did. So I said, you did? And he said, yeah, when I gave you absolution. He sounded like he was from India. So I says, okay. So I walked out, but I still, I don't think he even knew what it was, and I still don't know what it is. And I was told that many priests, it's an old tradition, and many priests, especially if they're young, they don't even know what it is. So could you expound on that for me, please? And how do you get it, and what does it do?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So what is called the apostolic pardon in some contexts is also called the apostolic blessing. And it is related to, it's a plenary indulgence given to someone in danger of death. So it's not normally given when you just go to confession. It's ordinarily given when someone is on their deathbed. The document that deals with this, the Apostolic Constitution of Paul VI, Indulgentiarum Doctrina, which is all about indulgences, has a special provision in there. It is norm number 18, where it says, to the faithful in danger of death who cannot be assisted by a priest to bring them to the sacraments and impart the apostolic blessing with its attendant plenary indulgence, and so on and so forth. And so what it's referring to there is the fact that in the ordinary case, when someone is on the verge of death, they are given last rites, as it's sometimes called. They're given the anointing of the sick. And if they appear to be facing death, they can also be given this apostolic blessing or the apostolic pardon. That is not the same as the forgiveness of sins and confession, because this is related to the penalties when it comes to purgatory. So you got this twofold consequence of sin. When you sin, when you commit a mortal sin, you cut yourself off from God. That's the eternal consequences of sin. You also do damage to yourself of the kind that ordinarily takes some process of purgation to heal. Purgation in this life or in purgatory. And so confession, and anytime you're forgiven your sin, that's dealing with the first category. You're being cut off from God. So now you're no longer cut off from God. But even someone who's been forgiven their sins, there might still be something that needs to be worked out, that you have some disordered relationship, you have some corruption in your soul, you have some consequence owing to the damage that you've done, that you need to be purified. And so the apostolic pardon is a plenary indulgence, and like any other plenary indulgence, is targeting those who are already forgiven of their sins, those who are not attached to sin, and it's about releasing them from anything that would hold them back in purgatory. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does make sense. And I would like to say, in relation to this, I came up with a concept. I don't know if the church would say this is legitimate or not, but we were taught, I guess, in physics class when we were younger, as far as purgatory is concerned, I came up with this concept of what we were taught, like, that, you may remember it, every action has an equal and opposite yeah. reaction. Could that be applied with purgatory? You know, every time you do something evil, there's something attached to that of the same, on the same level, you know, does that make sense?
I think you're on to something in a way. But I wouldn't put it in quite those terms, for the simple reason that the ordinary effect of our actions can create a consequence that we can't possibly pay for. Like, we can do damage that we can never undo. And so, thanks be to God, we're not just paid back a sort of eye for an eye, you know, the action-reaction mentality. And that's kind of the baseline understanding of morality, that actions have consequences, and therefore, you know, the eye for an eye standard in the Old Testament was built on the fact there should be an equal and opposite reaction, partly because otherwise you can have an escalating series of reactions where I do something to you, you do something worse to me, and then I decide to get you back even worse, and it just explodes. And so eye for an eye was a way of limiting it to an equal and opposite reaction. But Christ calls us to something even more radical in terms of the forgiveness of sins. Now, what you've also highlighted there, though, is that actions have consequences, that when I do something, that can create a lasting impact, and that lasting impact can be for good or for ill, depending on what it is that I've done. Now, if I can give you, I don't know if you want a little bit of homework or not, there's a document John Paul II wrote. It's called An Apostolic Exhortation, and the name of it is just Reconciliation and Penance, and there is a beautiful part in there where he talks about social sin and personal sin. It's paragraph 16, in which he talks about how all of our good and bad actions have this kind of ripple effect going outward that I think you'll find resonant with a lot of the things that you're already chewing on.
That sounds good. It makes sense. Does it, like, say, you mentioned last rites before, when you get last rites, does that automatically mean that you're going to bypass purgatory?
If you receive last rites and the apostolic blessing with the right spirit, you are contrite for your sins and you've no longer held on to sin, either mortal or venial, then you receive those things, you will bypass purgatory. And that should be the goal, by the way, of every Christian. Nobody should be aiming for purgatory. Like, nobody wants to aim for summer school. Like, aim for graduation.
Frank, thanks very much for the call. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. All our lines full. On we go to Iowa. Anna is in Iowa. Welcome, Anna. You got a question for Joe?
Hi. Thank you guys so much.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Anna.
My question... Oh, sorry. What?
No, he said hi, Anna.
We were saying hi.
But his wife is named Anna, too. So
I'm on autopilot saying hi, Anna. Yeah.
I know that this is kind of a tired question, and I really don't mean to, like, waste your guys' time with it, but... I mean, I've had a lot of conversations about it, and I still feel like it's kind of an impediment to, like, my faith. So I was just wondering, like how do all people not go to hell if, like, God truly desires what's good for them, and he understands that they also desire what's good? Like, for example, like, a non-believer.
You mean why didn't all people not go to heaven?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
I didn't know how dark this question was going to go. I just wanted to make sure. Okay, sorry. Go on.
Yeah, but... I mean, at least in my circles, I feel like it's oftentimes argued that, like, people choose to go to hell in the sense that, like, they, like, on earth, they are separated from God and they choose that for themselves. And then so, like, God honors their free will in a sense by, like, allowing them to continue to do so in their eternal fate. But, like, I mean, for my life at least, it's like, I would desire to go to heaven, but it's like, I just feel like there are, like, so many obstacles to belief, but, like, if I knew that it was true, I would definitely desire that. So, like, everyone is just, like, trying to do what they believe to be right, whether that's, like, totally distorted in their brain or not. Like, how is it justified that, like, God is just honoring what we want when what we truly want is probably for everyone to be in heaven?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so this gets, I don't think that your question was tired or silly or anything like that. And any question that causes a hindrance to your faith is always a question worth asking. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, we're told that God desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. And I think we have to start with that God creates us in love and desires that we should have a relationship with him. Nevertheless, it seems pretty clear from Scripture that some number of people, and we don't know how many, that some number of people reject the invitation. They reject the reason for which they were made, the reason for which they were created. And this creates those complicated questions of, on some level, all of us want happiness, and God alone can provide that happiness. And so this means one of two things. One, nobody would consciously reject God if they fully understood the stakes. If they really understood this is what would make them happy. It does seem that no one would ever choose hell, this is why, by the way, nobody ever leaves heaven. Once you experience the full goodness of God, you're never going to leave it, because it would just be unthinkable. It's not like you're forced into heaven, you know. You're not like, I really want to check out hell. And God's like, no, stay here. No, it's that the longings of your heart have been completely filled. On the flip side, our host didn't know about phones. on the flip side, you also have this situation where if somebody does freely reject God, the fact that their hearts are made to only be satisfied with infinite goodness and God alone is infinite goodness means that there's not some alternative place they could go and still be happy. So God can't make a heaven for those who don't want him, because definitionally what we're looking for is only found in him. Does that part make sense?
Yeah.
So this then raises the question of what it looks like to reject God. Because I think the linchpin here is that there's such a thing as ignorance and there's such a thing as lack of faith. And those aren't the same thing. Because we can always say, I want more information, I want more knowledge, I want more and more and more. You know, ultimately, I want God to give me all of the joy of heaven without me having to trust him at all, because then I don't have to make any act of faith. I don't have to put any trust at all, because he's just delivering on all of his promises here and now, and I can see it for myself. But the Christian life is set up where there's always a certain amount where I have every reason to say yes, but could also find reasons to say no. I have enough to motivate trusting him, but could also give myself an excuse not to trust him. He always leaves us with that out, unfortunately. And as a result, like, he really does want us to trust him. So it's not just a question of knowledge. It's also a question of, when I have enough to say yes, what do I do with that? Now, God alone knows whether you're at a, where you've been at a place where you've got enough to say yes and you're just being distrustful, or whether you're genuinely ignorant and don't know what it is you're being asked to say yes to. My point is just that there is a gap between the knowledge God wants to give us and the knowledge we want to have. And that he seems to leave that gap intentionally. He gives us enough reason to trust him, but not so much reason that there's no more room for trust. Last example I'll give that might help this. In a relationship, you give your spouse reason to trust you, but you don't like go to such extremes that, you know, like if they want to go through all of your phone messages and everything, there might be a point where you say that's actually insulting to the act of trust. Sorry, I didn't realize we were coming right up on the break, but hopefully that's helpful in making that. If you'd like to talk about it more on the other side of the break, we can.
Hang on, or, if you like, Anna.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Each Catholic is obliged to spread and defend the faith by word and deed. Well, we're here to help. Join special guests Chris Stefanik, Dr. David Anders, Father Jeff Kirby, and all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists this September 25th through 28th in beautiful San Diego for the Catholic Answers Conference. Our theme, Go Make Disciples. Enjoy 4 days of faith, fun, and fellowship. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 when you register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. I believe we still have Anna in Iowa with us with questions about hell. You still with us, Anna?
Yes, I am.
Hell's a tough one. Now, did you want to follow up with Joe on what he said? Or
I would love to, if possible.
Yes, please do.
I would feel really bad if you were like, no, I just wanted to say goodbye. We made you wait.
I was like, kind of hoping for a free book, but hey, whatever. All right, you're getting a free book before you go, Anna. But go ahead with your follow-up.
Well, I was just going to, like, I feel like what's difficult for me about that is that, like, I mean, you can, I don't mean you, but, like, it can be said that, like, that there's, like, enough for a person to, like, either believe or not believe based on whether they're willing to, like, make an act of faith. But I feel like it's really difficult when it's, like, you're not just choosing whether or not to trust a being that you, like, do think exists. Like, you're not judging almost, like, the character traits of that person and, like, choosing to put your faith in that. It's more so, like, determining whether something does or does not exist. And then from there, it's, like, a little bit more difficult, I guess, to just, like, set reason aside, because usually when we're determining whether or not something is true, like, our reason is the only thing by which we can judge that.
Well, I think even when we're judging if something's true, there is an act of trust. And this is, we don't often talk about it in those terms, but even if you said, I'm only going to go off of the latest, greatest, double-blind, peer-reviewed science, I'm still making an act of trust that the scientists in the journals are telling the truth about what their findings were. I'm not personally going in there and double-checking all the lab results. And it's possible they're not telling the truth. I mean, there's been several cases, and even the pretty recent past, where it's turned out the science was maybe not right because people weren't telling the truth about it. Or you have, like, the replication crisis and all this stuff. Without getting too much in the weeds on that, we constantly live by faith. Every time you drive through a green light and you assume everybody's going to stop at the red light, you're living by faith. You're taking your life in your hand, trusting in the much more fallible goodness and sanity of your neighbor. And so there's always this act where that's the only way any of us Christians, atheists, whatever, live. We always live by faith. We don't always think about it as much as we do in the context of choosing to trust in God. And with God, I would say, especially on the existence of God, the mere existence that there is a God is something I think can be pretty amply demonstrated. That there's, you know, all the different arguments for the existence of God. Take the argument from contingency. Everyone and everything you see that exists didn't have to be here. It exists only under certain conditions, is what's called contingent. But you can't have only contingent things in reality, or you wouldn't have anything. Meaning if literally everything only came into being under certain conditions, well, you would never have the conditions, and you would therefore never have anything. So there must be something other than what we see, something that is not contingent, something that the entire world depends on, the entire universe depends on, for its existence. Now, much more could be said kind of on that, but my point is that you follow those kind of lines, and you can say, okay, logically, there must be some kind of God. And then I have to figure out, is this God personal or just a force? Is this God good? Does this God deserve to be trusted? And that's where you get to the heart of the question we were talking about before the break, is I have to make some kind of act of trust. I started to give this example earlier, but like in a relationship, if you're, you know, married to someone, if you're dating someone, whatever, you want to give them every reason to trust you. But there is a point where you might say they're going too far. If they say, I demand to see your bank accounts, I demand to see your emails, I demand to see, you know, I want to trace everywhere you've ever been. There's a way in which that becomes insulting. And you say, I need you to actually trust me. I've given you every reason to trust me. I need you to actually do it. And it seems that there is a point at which God says the same to us. He has given us plenty of reasons to trust him, but he at some point demands that we actually do it, that we actually trust. And so that's not a matter of, you know, faith against reason, but it is recognizing that reason leads to a rational step in faith, but there still has to be an act of the will where we choose to trust as opposed to choosing to distrust. I don't know. What do you make of all that, Anna?
Yeah, I definitely see what you're saying. Part of it that I still like struggle with is like, I mean, not to like get into, you know, like the weeds, as you said, of like different arguments and like whatever, but like if a person's reason still doesn't like lead them to that place where it's like a smaller leap of faith, I guess you could say, than like if you were to like really understand those, like if it's all a misunderstanding, but they still don't like think that that's true, then I guess like that arises like a little bit of questioning or doubt for me. And then also like why should the act of trusting necessarily be rewarded with eternal like happiness, whereas like an act of distrust like necessarily means that you must suffer forever? Like,
wow.
I guess that's a little bit confusing to me still.
Great, Hannah,
yeah, no, that's very well said, too, that there is this sense in which, like I said, we're meant to be in relationship with God, but he doesn't want to just have us know him, but to love him. And there is an intimate relationship between that act of trust and the act of love. And so in our relationship with God, it isn't just here's some facts about the nature of reality or here's some facts about theology. But all of this is in service of this relational dynamic of saying a yes to one pursuing us in love. And so that no isn't just an act of distrust. There can be an actual act of a lack of love, of choosing to reject the divine overture. And so then, understood that way, if there is one for whom, yeah, I mean, think about it, these people talk about it in the kind of the romantic sense of like a soulmate, like, oh, you've got this soulmate, and if you were to say no to them, you'd be unhappy forever. Now, I don't believe that at the level of romance. I do believe that at the level of theology, that there is one bridegroom of the soul. And if we say no to him, we're not going to find anyone else who makes us happy in the way that he does. And so that dooms us to a life of unhappiness by virtue of him being the only one who can satisfy us. But having said all that, I want to be really clear that the really hard questions about who has enough evidence and how are they judged based on that, thanks be to God, those are not questions that are left to us to sort out. God knows what our yes looks like. If you read Romans 2, St. Paul talks about the Gentiles and how their hearts will convict or excuse them on the day of judgment because they show by their conduct the law of God written on their hearts and whether they listened to it or not. That on every human heart, God is already speaking to us. That even our knowledge, no one had to tell you murder was wrong, right? Like, there's a way you already knew all of that stuff. And the reason you already knew all that stuff is because God had already been speaking to you in the depths of your heart, the kind of moral core each one of us has within. And so you've already been in some relationship with him, consciously or not, your entire life. You've reacted to him positively or negatively by obedience or by sinning throughout your life. And this is true whether you grew up Christian, whether you grew up non-believer, whatever the case may be. And so God can sort through all of those things. I would just say he's already begun that work. And the sooner we recognize that and make a conscious yes to it, the better.
Anna, I'll tell you what, I'd like to send you a copy of a book we have called The Big Book of Catholic Answers. I think you will find it interesting. You're obviously a deep thinker on these things. So these are just lots and lots of questions about the Catholic faith with answers that go with them. You look like you wanted to say something, Joe.
Well, I was just going to invite her to continue to call in. I mean, like she's asking some really big, really important questions. And I want to respect everybody else on the line, but I don't want to keep a conversation this important shorter than it needs to be. So please let this be the first of many. And, you know, I'm here almost every Wednesday, and I know everybody else on Catholic Answers would love to engage, and maybe you'll find somebody else who can approach it from a slightly different angle that might be helpful as well. So please keep calling in.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you very much for the call. Hang on. Just give us an address. We'll send you off the Big Book of Catholic Answers. Going up to Oxnard, California, north of us, Bob in Oxnard is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Bob, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, great. Quickly on the last call, I think the Purgatory for Real book would be good for her because she's struggling with the categorical nature of heaven or hell on-off, and a lot of the Christians who don't believe in purgatory. They kind of think that.
I'm putting it on the list to give her.
I like and you that get, callers are now giving other callers books.
He gets 15% for acting as her agent. So could we also send Bob 15% of Purgatory
is
for Real?
So my question is, why don't apologists more frequently use the availability of confession as a Catholic apologetics called a sales point when, you know, our confession so much more biblical, historical, and obviously beneficial than what you get in a lot of these other, I don't know all of them, but like, you know, the Calvinism, it's like you're worried all the time if you're saved or not saved. And it just seems like this is a good point for us. And I hardly ever hear it mentioned. We hear about the Eucharist, but the flip side of that communion coin is really confession. So that's my question.
I think in terms of the sales pitch side of it, as you put it,
yeah,
a lot of Protestant denominations, by no means all, but many Protestant denominations have this idea of once saved, always saved, or perseverance of the saints, or some sense that you can know that you're saved and can never become unsaved no matter what you do. And so from just the level of sort of security, It's like, oh, wow, I've got eternal security. I could literally murder someone and it wouldn't change my salvation. Now, that's grossly unbiblical. It is contradicted all over the place in the New Testament. You have 2 Peter 2 that's written entirely about those who were ransomed by Christ who then deny him and are worse off than before. Hebrews 6 talks about that. I mean, there's plenty of places. Acts 8, you see an actual case of Simon getting baptized, coming to faith, clearly being saved, and then losing his salvation. You see these cases all over the place. But you have people who believe in that, so they don't think they need confession. And one of the ways that I think the enemy numbs us spiritually is convincing us our sin isn't so bad. Like, there's only two moves he really has. Either tell us our sin isn't that bad, we don't need confession, we don't need to be forgiven, or tell us our sin is so bad, we couldn't possibly be forgiven. Those are the two moves that he has. And so when you're talking to anybody, it's worth discerning, where are they on that? Do they see themselves as a sinner in need of forgiveness? Do they think their sin is trivial, or that their sin is already paid for in a way that it's trivial to them? Or do they think their sin is so bad they couldn't possibly be forgiven? And then once you know that, I think you know how to approach with confession. And for many people, this is incredibly good news, because they realize they need to be forgiven and they need to hear the words of Jesus announcing their forgiveness spoken through the priest. Other people are going to find confession to be a hurdle because they say, oh, I can just go directly to God. I don't need to worry about it. Or they're afraid to tell a priest. And so confession is a tricky one on a psychological level, because even though it's an act of mercy, there is still this need to acknowledge my sinfulness. And sometimes that doesn't feel great. So different personality types, different spiritual traditions, you might have a different sort of reaction to confession.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Bob, absolutely, Bob.
Thank you very much for the call. Can we, Bob, hang on. We want to get an address so we can send you.
We're going to let the next caller figure out what Bob gets.
Yeah, the next. That would be a good
thing. Pay it forward.
Well, let's give him at least 15% of purgatory is for real. If you guys want to give him the whole 100%, that's up to you. But at least 15% of purgatory.
I think he probably already
real.
Has that one, because he mentioned how good it was.
Oh, that's true. Or any other book that he wants of Joe's. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
With news from EWTN's Vatican Bureau, you can watch all of the important events from Rome even if you don't have TV access. Using the latest technology, we've made it possible to watch the latest news from the Holy See, all delivered directly to your home via live streams. Watch live on EWTN's YouTube channel and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I've been loath to mention the Rhine River cruise because I thought our boss, Chris Check, was going to come in here and talk about it, but I haven't seen him. Maybe he'll come in later, but I haven't seen him yet. So let me talk about the Rhine River cruise. Joe Heschmeyer will be featured on our Rhine River cruise coming up in May of next year, May 2026. So we're giving you plenty of warning on this because the whole boat is going to sell out. We go on these beautiful ships. I have never been on one of these, but and we start in Amsterdam and end in Basel. I'm not sure. I guess it depends on where you are, how you pronounce that one. But I'm going to say Basel, and you see Cologne and Dusseldorf, and just so much of the heartland of Northern European Christianity. I get to visit so much of the history, including the tombs of the three kings, and just so much great stuff. Joe will be there. Chris Check will be there. I get to go this time, and Father Sebastian Walsh, the author of Secrets from Heaven that you hear us give out so often, will be our chaplain on this cruise. It's going to be magnificent. 25% sold out already, and we're still 13 months away from it. So just go to Catholic. You can go to catholic.com/cruise. That might be the easiest way to do it, or just type in Catholic Answers Cruise in your searching machine. It'll get you somewhere near there, but catholic.com/cruise. Joe, the whole time I was saying that, you looked like you were going to interrupt me and say something. What is on your mind about all this?
Repeatedly was going to add things and thought that's just a diversion, and then was going to find out what the other, I think it was like Catholic Cruise, but I couldn't remember the name of the website.
Oh yeah.
So we're a good pair there. Well, yeah, catholic.com/cruise. You can also look up Catholic Answers Rhine or Catholic Answers Cruises on the YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean, on Google. I'm sorry.
On the YouTube.
Sorry, companion today. Well, yeah, whatever. Yeah. You can try YouTube. I don't know what'll happen.
If you would like to see 8 days of beautiful Europe that includes lots of Joe interrupting me in a completely unhelpful way, exactly. Join us for the Catholic Answers.
Well, I would just
Rhineland
say, for anyone discerning it, just go to Google Maps, look up Cologne. And look at how pretty it is. And then be like, I'd like to see that.
And then come on. It amazes me that 100% of the cabins are going to be with our folks. It'll be a whole Catholic Answers thing. We'll get to do talks and prayer together on the ship, all that stuff. But 25% already sold. So check it out at catholic.com/cruise. We'd love it if you would come. All right. We are heading to Joe's former stomping grounds, Overland Park, Kansas.
I like the way you pronounce that.
Or I didn't know if I should Basel or Basel? Overland or Overland? Overland.
We say Overland, but it is pointing out, like, aren't all parks overland? But anyway.
Oh, my God. No, actually, not all parks are overland. Did you know that we have an underwater park in the United States off the coast of the Florida Keys? A huge park.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a park underwater. I've actually dove into there. What's the past tense of... Dived there. Cooper, I'm sorry I kept you waiting. Cooper in Overland Park, Kansas. Go ahead with your question.
That's all good. Thank you, guys. I just wanted to appreciate Catholic Answers and Joe's podcast. They both helped to bring me fuller into the Catholic faith.
Oh, praise God.
Thank you guys for that.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Wonderful.
My question today is about free will and death. I've always heard, you know, God takes you when it's your time, and I've heard a quote that says you're invincible until God's plan for you is run out. So that's like a reason we shouldn't be afraid as Christians, but I also have questions about how things like suicide play into that, because I would assume if suicide is a mortal sin, then how could that be part of God's plan to, you know, gather us up into heaven? And then I mean, that kind of conflicts with what I've heard about the problem of evil as well, and that, you know, God's not the evil one. Humans are the ones using their free will to do evil, and that can take people's life. And so I'm assuming that wouldn't be God's plan, because it's allowing somebody to commit a sin in order for that to happen. So I guess I just don't know how free will, our own free will and other people's free will plays into our life.
Yeah, that's very well structured. When we talk about God's will, we want to understand it in two ways, because we can talk about something's called the antecedent and consequent will of God, or his permissive and active will. There's other ways different theologians kind of formulate it. The basic idea is this. In one sense, everything that happens, God permits it to happen. He could stop everything from happening. So in one very broad sense of the will of God, he permitted it to happen, and he has some reason he permitted it, that he can draw some good out of the situation. That doesn't mean he desires everything that happens, because that includes every bad thing, every wicked deed, every horrendous evil. And so we can talk about his desire and then his permissive will. And so when someone dies, it could be that God desired this be the end of their life and that they come home at this point. It could be that he permitted them to take their own life, or someone else to take their life, or any number of bad decisions to intervene, you know. Even if you stop short of obvious cases like suicide, if somebody's like texting while driving, are we going to say, oh, God willed that they do that so that they could die and go to heaven? No, that's not how we understand the will of God accurately. So this is one of those phrases that gets kind of thrown around that doesn't have good theological roots. Now, God permits, every hair that falls from your head, every sparrow that falls from the sky, and every person that falls to their death to die. He permits that, and he'll draw good from it if we're open to him drawing good. But that doesn't mean he desires all of those things. Jesus can weep at the tomb of Lazarus even as he's going to draw good from Lazarus's death, namely by raising him up again. Does that distinction help, Cooper?
Yeah, that helps. I guess my thought was kind of in my personal life, like just actions I have. Sometimes I'm too scared to make those actions because I'm afraid, you know, it could lead me to an early death, and I, you know, of course I don't want that, and I'm just afraid that, you know, I did want some kind of security in that, you know, God will take me whenever. But
what kind of action are you talking about, like getting a motorcycle, or what are we talking about here?
No. I sometimes, you know, just scared of travel, especially by airplane.
Big airplane guy.
And so I just, my thought is always, you know, it's my free will decision to take that risk, mm-hmm. I guess. It's probably just not putting enough trust in God, but it's also, you know, I think of those cases where your free will might play a part into it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this will help or not, but mile per mile, car travel is more dangerous than plane travel. So, I mean, maybe I'm not suggesting you should just go be a hermit in your house, but yeah, every time you go outside, every time you take a bite of food that's big enough you could choke on it, there's a sense in which you could be taking your life in your hands. And I think the solution to that is not to have an unhealthy fear of death, to recognize that when you die, you die. And if we want to talk about that in terms of your time being up, fine, I guess, in one sense. But I think a better way to talk about it is be ready for the moment of your death to come, whenever that may be, because you don't know when God will call you home. You don't know when you'll die. But one thing that I think should be very clear, even if some action you take involves some like fluke accident and you die, that is, first of all, a very different category than something like intentional suicide or even recklessly endangering your own life. And second, it's not like any form of death is surprising God, where it's like, oh, you're here too early. Heaven's not ready for you. Or, you know, my plan for you involved 27 more years. I don't know what to do with you now. It's not going to be anything like that. God knows right now what the end of your life is going to look like. And he knows how your free will is going to play into that. And so it is true that you don't need to be worried excessively about that. That doesn't mean you should be reckless. It doesn't mean you should be stupid. But it also means you shouldn't live, you know, cowering behind the fact that you could potentially die. There are much worse things than dying. And you want to live a life to the fullness for God's sake. And that probably includes not excessively worrying about dangers that you don't have much control over.
Okay, yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Good. All right, I'm happy to hear that.
I tell you what, I mentioned that book, Secrets from Heaven, Cooper. I want to send it to you. If you want it, hang on. We'll send you Secrets from Heaven, the book, a beautiful book about the sayings and parables of Jesus by our good friend, Father Sebastian Walsh. Coming near to the break, I feel bad Susan in Idaho waited a long time, but we'll get back to you as quick as we can next hour, Susan, and everybody else on the line. All the lines are full. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and we're going to continue with Ask Me Anything when we come back. John Pennekamp, Coral Reef State Park. That's what I was referring to.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's part of, I think it's part of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary.
I didn't know.
Is there anything
about that.
Else you'd like to know about underwater parks?
I just figured that seems like an easy place to lose your keys.
Yes, in the Florida Keys, you have to be careful with your keys. You attach a little floaty onto them just for this very reason.
So there you go.
And every now and then you see someone's keys floating by. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, he will answer any questions. He will make a pun about anything. He will interrupt you when you're trying to do the ad. He's just an all-around great guy. And he's the proprietor of Shameless Popery, one of the best podcasts in the whole podcast universe. You can check it out. Just type in Shameless Popery. You can type it. You can go to Shameless Joe. You can go to Joe Heschmeyer's YouTube page. But get it, watch it, learn it, be a better person. All right, we're going to take a very, very, what? That's sincere. No, you look like I was not being sincere.
Thanks for some of that. Yeah, appreciate it.
I think you misinterpreted my sincerity. I thought. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.